Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm Hewlett Follett, your host. On our program this week, I'm talking with Jeff Gold of the Department of Philosophy at ETSU, and our topic is mysticism. Jeff, glad to have you with us.
Thanks, I'm glad to be here.
The topic is mysticism. It would be helpful if you began just by briefly explaining what you take mysticism to be.
Well, it might be easier to sort of draw a contrast to understand mysticism. Perhaps we could draw a contrast between theology and mysticism, or what a theologian, how a theologian approaches things and how a mystic approaches things. For a theologian, what the task of a theologian is to try and clarify and explain difficult religious concepts, difficult theological concepts, like the concept of divinity, or the concept of sacredness, or the concept of faith. And what a theologian would like to do is explain those concepts so that we can understand them, make them more clear to us, more comprehensible to us. So it's an intellectual task that involves making ideas of religion clear to the ordinary person. The mystic, on the other hand, is less interested in analyzing concepts and understanding ideas, and is more interested in experience. And so for what the mystic seeks is not so much to understand the concept of the divine, but, oh, to use the Jewish mystical term, devakut, to cleave to the divine. The mystic is less interested in understanding the nature of sacredness and more interested in experiencing the sacred life. So mystics are in general interested in what's often called direct immediate experience of the mystery or something like that.
So if the emphasis is on experience, what prompts mystical experiences? Do they just sort of come in from bolts, like bolts in the blue, or are there things that individuals do to prepare themselves in some ways for the chance of having a mystical experience?
I think the answer to that is both. I think that there are lots of cases historically that we see where it has happened out of the blue. Perhaps the case of Saul's transformation to Paul is one of those cases where somebody had no preparatory work whatsoever and simply had what's often called a mystical experience. And on the other hand, though a number of mystical traditions will give sort of do's and don'ts that might make it more likely to have certain kinds of experiences. For example, in Buddhism, you have the Noble Eightfold Path, and in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, you've got the eight limbs of things you should do or not do to overcome obstacles. None of them are guarantees, but you'll see emphasis on things like diet, things you should and shouldn't eat, fasting, possibly something in yoga called pratyahara, which is sense withdrawal, or pranayama, which is breath control. There may be other things. In both the eight limbs of yoga and the Noble Eightfold Path in Buddhism, you get an emphasis on certain what we might call moral precepts, the main one being ahimsa, or non-injury, or non-violence. And that applies to thought, word, and deed, to not have harmful, angry thoughts, harmful angry speech, or harmful angry action. These are all attempts by certain mystical traditions to say that if you do this sort of thing, you might remove some obstacles to having mystical experiences and might put yourself in a position where you're more likely to have them. But on the other hand, your question's a good one. Sometimes it happens to people who do no preparatory work, and sometimes it doesn't happen to people who have engaged in certain preparation. So I guess that's how I'd answer that.
Would it be fair to say, though, that most of people who are part of mystical traditions would see there being very important that there be some kinds of preparatory work?
Yeah, within the tradition, told to watch your diet, to watch the sorts of thoughts you have, pay attention when you get angry, to and of course more than anything else, well, at least in the traditions that I'm most familiar with, there's a real emphasis on meditation as a daily practice. As, again, I wouldn't want to say it's required, but as a technique that will make you more open to certain states of awareness.
Could you say a little bit about meditation? I mean, what does it standardly mean within?
Okay. By meditation, I mean the ability to quiet down the mind. It's the art of learning how to sit down and shut up, and not just shut up in terms of speech, but in terms of thought. Our minds are very, very active, filled with emotion, filled with desire. And let's say in the tradition I'm most familiar with, in, for example, the Jewish tradition, in Psalms chapter 46:11, it says, "Be still and know I'm God." And then in Psalms chapter 4, verse 5, it says, "Commune with your own heart on your bed and be still." In Isaiah chapter 30, it talks about ease and rest and stillness as absolutely essential to living properly. And so there's this emphasis, and not just in Jewish mysticism, but in all these traditions of quieting the mind. And I think the best passage to understand why that's important, there's a passage in 1 Kings chapter 19 where Elijah climbs the Mount of the Lord. And when he gets to the peak of the Mount of the Lord, there are three sort of colossal events. There's an earthquake, there's a storm, and there's a fire. And in each case, it says that God was not in the earthquake, God was not in the storm, and God was not in the fire. But Elijah finally discovered God in what the scriptures say is the still, small voice. And so the idea is that whatever it is that one gets in touch with in a mystical experience, that is fairly quiet, fairly subtle. And the noise of the mind, the thoughts, the desires, the emotion often drown it out. It's a little bit like going on a camping trip up on Roan Mountain to commune with nature and hear the sounds of nature, like the owl and the crickets and the cicadas and the wind through the leaves. But then when you get to the top of the mountain, putting on a Walkman and listening to a CD or a tape, what would happen is nature would still be making those noises, but the tape would drown it out. And similarly, what mystics say, if they're monotheistic mystics like Jewish mystics, then they'll talk about the voice of God being still and small and quiet. If they're not religious mystics, but let's say Buddhist or something like that, they'll still talk about a quiet, still, the Buddha mind is very quiet and still. So in all these traditions, there's an emphasis on meditation or stilling the mind, because otherwise the idea is you simply won't be aware of these other states of awareness because they're too subtle, and as I said, the noise of the mind will drown them out.
So that a lot of what's going on when you're talking about preparing for a mystical experience is not so much what you're trying to do, is in some sense what you're trying to undo, what you're trying to sweep away, what you're trying to clear away to make space.
That's a wonderful description. I like that a lot.
One other thing associated with the notion of meditation that sometimes comes out that I know you have some interest in is the idea of mindfulness. Does that play a role, and could you say a little bit about what that role would be?
Mindfulness is the idea of being fully present in the moment, being because we're often distracted, and our mind, we all know the experience of reading three or four pages of a book and then recognizing that we don't know the thing we read because we weren't paying attention, or oftentimes we're watching TV and talking on the phone and washing the dishes all at once. And mindfulness is this idea of doing something with what you would say in the Jewish or Christian tradition is with all your heart, all your soul, and all your might, a kind of 100%-ness. And so the Zen Buddhists say, when you wash the dishes, just wash the dishes. And that takes a lot of practice, and meditation practice helps with that, because there are really very few things in the world more boring than watching your breath. And so you have to learn how to practice that and find fullness in that, because there really is fullness in it. It's just that we live in a kind of Disneyland world with all sorts of lights and buzzers and sounds, and so it's real easy to be more distracted. And so mindfulness is a kind of practice that it's both a practice and, on the other hand, it's something to be cultivated on these traditions.
Okay, and it's connected with meditation and the idea of mystical experiences by paying attention to the little things, in a sense. I mean, you use the language about listening to the still, small voice of God. You talked about quieting. What all those seem to be saying is that you're only going to hear it if you're not distracted, if you're attentive to what's going on. And by the same token, mindfulness is almost the daily mystical experience.
Yeah, oh, that's good, yeah. And they talk about mindfulness while walking, while washing the dishes, while going to the bathroom. So one works on it, and it's, you know, nobody achieve, or most of us don't achieve it very easily, but you work on it, and I guess it's just like athletics. You lift weights and you get better and better and better at it, and similarly, if you practice these things, you get better at them.
Now there's a question. If you have a mystical experience, how does it change one, or does it change one, other than just being able to say, well, gee, I had one of those? I mean, does it change our understanding of ourselves, our relationships with each other?
I think often it does. I think with many people, having an experience ends up being transformative. I think it's possible someone could have an experience and it not have that kind of deep impact on them. But with many people, it's transformative. I have a story that I think I'd like to read that says a little bit about sort of what happens when you come out of it, or at least to one person. This is a story written by an American who studied in Japan, studied Aikido, which is a martial art, for many, many years. And this is a true story of something that happened to him. And these are in his words. He says, "The train clanked and rattled through the suburbs of Tokyo on a drowsy spring afternoon. At one station, the doors opened, and suddenly the afternoon quiet was shattered by a man bellowing violent, incomprehensible curses. The man staggered into our car. He wore laborer's clothing, and he was big, drunk, and dirty. Screaming, he swung at a woman holding a baby. It was a miracle the baby was unharmed. The train lurched ahead, the passengers frozen with fear. I stood up. I was young then, some 20 years ago, and in pretty good shape. I'd been putting in a solid 8 hours of Aikido training nearly every day for the past 3 years. The trouble was, my martial skill was untested in actual combat. As students of Aikido, we were not allowed to fight. Aikido, my teacher had said again and again and again, is the art of reconciliation. Whoever has the mind to fight has broken his connection with the universe. I listened to his words. I tried hard. I even went so far as to cross the street to avoid the pinball punks who lounged around the train stations. My forbearance exalted me. I felt both tough and holy. In my heart, however, I wanted an absolutely legitimate opportunity whereby I might save the innocent by destroying the guilty. This is it, I said to myself as I got to my feet. People are in danger. If I don't do something fast, somebody will probably get hurt. Seeing me stand up, the drunk recognized the chance to focus his rage. Aha, he roared, a foreigner. You need a lesson in Japanese manners. I held on lightly to the commuter strap overhead and gave him a slow look of disgust and dismissal. All right, he hollered. You're going to get a lesson. He gathered himself for a rush at me. A fraction of a second before he could move, someone shouted, hey! It was ear-splitting. I wheeled to my left. The drunk spun to his right. We both stared down at a little old Japanese man. He must have been well into his 70s, this tiny gentleman, sitting there immaculate in his kimono. He took no notice of me, but beamed delightedly at the laborer, as though he had a most important, most welcome secret to share. "Come here," the old man said in easy vernacular. "Come here and talk with me." The big man followed as if on a string. He planted his feet belligerently in front of the old gentleman and roared, "Why the hell should I talk to you?" The old man continued to beam at the laborer. "What you been drinking?" he asked, his eyes sparkling with interest. "I've been drinking sake," the laborer bellowed back, "and it's none of your business." Flecks of spittle spattered the old man. "Oh, that's wonderful," the old man said, "absolutely wonderful. You see, I love sake, too. Every night, me and my wife, she's 76, you know, we warm up a little bottle of sake and take it out into the garden, and we sit on an old wooden bench. We watch the sun go down, and we look to see how our persimmon tree is doing. Our great-grandfather planted that tree. It's gratifying to watch the tree when we take our sake and go out in the evening, even when it rains." He looked up at the laborer, eyes twinkling. As he struggled to follow the old man's conversation, the drunk's face began to soften. His fist slowly unclenched. "Yeah," he said, "I love persimmons, too." His voice trailed off. "Yes," said the old man, smiling, "and I'm sure you have a wonderful wife." "No," replied the laborer, "my wife died." Very gently, swaying with the motion of the train, the big man began to sob. "I don't got no wife. I don't got no home. I don't got no job. I'm so ashamed of myself." Tears rolled down his cheeks. Now it was my turn. Standing there in my well-scrubbed youthful innocence, my make this world safe for democracy righteousness, I suddenly felt dirtier than he was. The train arrived at my stop. As the doors opened, I heard the old man cluck sympathetically, "My, my, that is a difficult predicament indeed. Sit down here and tell me about it." I turned for one last look. The laborer was sprawled on the seat, his head in the old man's lap. As the train pulled away, I sat down on a bench. What I had wanted to do with muscle had been accomplished with kind words. I had just seen Aikido, true Aikido, tried in combat, and the essence of it was love. Now, in that story, the little old Japanese man, it seems to me, was able to see things that most of us wouldn't have seen. Certainly the American who told the story wasn't able to see it. And my suspicion is that the little old Japanese man had done practices for enough years that he was able to rest in a place where he was able to see the laborer a little differently than most of us would have seen the laborer. And from that vantage point, he was able, if I can put it this way, to change the dance. He was able to help the laborer come up for air. And it seems to me that what the essence of mysticism is that you change from the inside out and you work on yourself so that you can be there for another. And that's why I like that story of the little old Japanese man, because I think that's what he was able to do.
So what happened in the case of the story is there are two sorts of changes that have gone on, or related changes, maybe the best way to say it, that somehow the man had undergone certain mystical experiences that made him understand himself differently and therefore made him more receptive to and understand and relate to this laborer differently. Would that generally be true of the sorts of changes you think mysticism brings, but both in our understanding of ourselves and in our relation to others?
I think so. I think that probably the little old Japanese man could see the connection between himself and the laborer, could imagine himself getting drunk and upset and angry and had a sense that something may be causing this angry display that he saw with the laborer. And after years of meditative practice and watching his own emotions and watching how he responded to situations, may have aided him in being able to see that in the laborer, and to see and then, because he didn't take it personally, but because he, as I said, stood at a slightly different vantage point, he was in a position, instead of just responding by punching the laborer or having a fight with the laborer, he was in a position to change the dance. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but he was at least in a position to do that. Whereas the Aikido American Aikido student was not.
So the claim isn't that suddenly every problem will disappear, every person, every drug laborer will suddenly become reasonable. It's just that it makes it more likely, more possible for it to happen, that you open up possibilities that you might not have had otherwise.
Yes, I think that's right. The way I like to put it is you give people a space to come up for air, and sometimes they'll come up for air and sometimes they won't. And so, yeah, it's not going to solve every problem, and it's not going to fix everything. But, yeah, it gives an opportunity. So I like the way you put that.
Okay. Now, we've sort of been talking about mystical experiences. And I think in a way, actually, some of the things you said have talked about what those experiences would be like. But maybe it would be helpful if you just spend a couple of minutes to talk about the way... Okay, I was going to say describe mystical experiences, but I realize that, given your opening answer, may be a bit misleading because, in some sense, the aim is not to describe. But nonetheless, I assume that people who have mystical experiences have some kind of vocabulary that they use to discuss what's gone on. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about what that would be.
It is hard because it's like trying to describe the indescribable. In Hinduism, we're told that Brahman is beyond nama rupa, beyond name and form. The opening of the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu says the Tao that can be described is not the real Tao. In Hebrew, the ineffable name of God is not pronounceable. And so as soon as you try to put it into words, it's a little bit like trying to put God in a box. It's difficult, and mystics have always struggled with that because they usually say things like it's ineffable, it can't be described. Maybe it's a little bit like someone who's deeply in love and who has had understands the experience of love, but simply can't describe it very well, can't articulate it very well, or the smell of a rose. We don't have very good language to describe it. Maybe that's close. I don't know.
Still seems that there probably are some things that go on in the experience that are related to the kinds of changes that you say that go on. For instance, I know that one of the words I've often heard people use when they talk about mysticism is the idea of oneness. Something about oneness.
Okay.
And to go back to the story that you give of the old Japanese man and the laborer, in a sense, what the story is, a story, sort of like a story of oneness, that the old Japanese man sees a deep commonality with a laborer that the American and Aikido student didn't see. Am I forcing something here, or is there a relationship between the character, the experience, and the way in which it changes people?
No, that's a good question. And yes, you will find a lot of people writing on mysticism saying it's an experience of unity where sort of self falls away and there's an experience of a unity or connectedness, sometimes with the natural world, sometimes with the divine world, sometimes with other human beings, sometimes with the planet Earth, in which boundaries and individual ways in which we're sort of packaged as individual and separate, like separate billiard balls or something, sort of falls away. And yeah, it is often described that way. Sometimes experiences are described as somewhat passive. In other words, it feels like something that happens to you rather than something you do. Those are some of the ways it's described.
And would it then be related in those sorts of ways to how it changes you?
Oh, okay, I see where you're going.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that it's like the experience, insofar as it's an experience of connectedness with others, and it feels like a very harmonious, sometimes even loving experience, that then the impact it has on you is to try to be more connected with others, more loving, more compassionate. It feels like sometimes waves of bliss or compassion, and then when you're in that state, you tend to be more attuned to the needs of others, more compassionate. So I think there is a connection there.
Okay. Now, this is part of a series on religion, and one of the questions that comes to mind is, we had a show on Judaism, we had a show on Islam, on Buddhism, and now we're in the show on mysticism, and one temptation would be to see that, well, okay, there's Christian religion, there's the Jewish religion, there's Islam, there's Buddhism, and then there's mysticism, as if it were a separate religion. But yet, in describing it, you talked about the Hindu mystics, the Jewish mystics, the Christian mystics, the Buddhist mystics. What's the relationship, just very briefly because we're running out of time, is it its own religion, or is it something that's pervasive through a variety of other religions? What's the best way of thinking about the connection here?
Most of the religious traditions that I'm aware of have certain kinds of mysticism associated with them. So there's Judaism, and then there's also Jewish mysticism, and Jewish mysticism is very much informed by Judaism, and the relationship between the two varies in certain times of periods of history. Sometimes the Jewish mystics get along very well with the more traditionalists. Sometimes there's more animosity. The same is true in Christian mysticism. The same is true as in Islamic mysticism. I think you find a little more animosity, at least at some periods of history, in those traditions than in the East, since Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism are so mystically oriented to begin with. But though all mystics say fairly similar things, they are often embedded in religious traditions and very much dependent on those traditions. So there will be certain features of Jewish mysticism which will be very different than Buddhist mysticism, despite the talk of ineffability and compassion and all the rest. There will be some different features. And of course, you can be a mystic without having any particular religious tradition. There are nature mystics, so it doesn't have to be connected to a religious tradition.
Okay. So the answer is, in a sense, both. That it can, to some extent, stand on its own. There are certain commonalities, and yet it's often informed by and informs some other religion.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for appearing in the show today.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
I've been talking today with Jeff Gold from ETSU's Philosophy Department. This is Hugh LaFont for Ideas and Issues. Good day.